This is Colorado Public Radio. I'm Ryan Warner. Thanksgiving weekend is traditionally when skiing and snowboarding rev up. And today we're going to ski down memory lane and hear about the sport's earliest days from some of the pioneers themselves, like Klaus Obermeier of Aspen, early ski bum and founder of the winter apparel company Sport Obermeier. He's about to turn 93 and he's still skiing. I spoke with Klaus in 2007 about the first article of ski clothing he crafted, a parka made from something he had around the house.
I cut up my down comforter, but I had feathers in my cereal for 3 weeks after that. Feathers flying all over the place. But it worked. It looked like Michelin, man. It didn't look very elegant, but it was warm and you could ski in it, you know. And I put a zipper on it from an old parka I had. I took that off and put it on the new down parka.
When and where was this?
That was in 1948 in Aspen.
And what were most people wearing when they went skiing in the 40s in Aspen?
Well, they usually had just a kind of a cheap dress shirt and a cheap sweater and maybe a shell, you know, like an anorak, a Norwegian anorak that was not lined, that was just was made of cotton and nylon mixture. That was it. So that wasn't very warm.
No, it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like skiing would have been a pretty bitter experience.
Yeah, a bitter cold.
Yeah, which would make you bitter, I guess. Well, so I wonder...
It could.
How do you get the idea that, well, more people should have this? I mean, were people expressing interest in it as you whizzed by?
Well, the thing was, I had a student in my class, and he said, "Oh, Klaus, can I try that jacket once?" I said, "Sure." So he tried it, and he liked it so much, you know, kept him warm going up the 15-minute lift ride on the world's longest single chairlift in Aspen. And he said, I'll buy it from you for $350. I give you $350. I said, wow, that's a lot of money because you could buy a new Buick at that time for $1,250 with radio. So that gave me the courage then the next summer to go back to Munich. I had a friend there that had a bedding factory, and I asked him to make me down parkas. He said, "Oh, hell no, I'm not making parkas. I make pillows and comforters." And so we went down to the Hofbräuhaus and we had a few beer, and that softened him up enough. He said, "Okay, I'll make you these parkas, but you got to get me the little knitted wristbands, and you got to find the zippers for it," which I did. And so he made me 75 of them. And they were a lot better than the one I had made from the comforter, that's for sure. They looked nice. So he made them, I brought them back here, and they sold like, what they say, hot rolls in the morning, you know?
Yeah, sold like hotcakes, or cold cakes,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Cold hotcakes.
So you eventually started production in Aspen. In other words, so how did that happen?
In Aspen, I had 17 seamstresses making parkas. And we made a kind of a Bavarian quilt parka, and that sold very well. We sold them by the dozen assorted to the shops, you know.
I can't help but wonder why this market hadn't come along by then. In other words, there were all those people freezing their tushes off on the slopes. And when you started making this, was there competition to be had immediately or what?
You know, at that time, like 47, 48, 49, 50, skiing was a very, very small sport in the United States. It was too small for an industry to develop to make clothing that would work for it.
Give me another example of an innovation that Obermeier brought to the market.
We did all kinds of things. We did the first mirror glasses, the first suntan lotion that worked at this elevation. People used to just burn up in end of February, March, April. They came here for a two-week vacation. They left after 2 days burned up from the sunshine. And the reason why we did it was to keep the people here. You know, so when they came for 14-day vacation, they really spent 14 days here and didn't leave after 2-3 days. The money part, and that was kind of totally secondary. The primary thing was to keep people happy that came to Aspen that were willing to learn to ski or skied already some. And so they kept coming back and brought their friends, and we got some business.
You're an aeronautical engineer by training.
Yes.
You moved here from Germany.
Yes.
Quickly became enamored with skiing in this country. And how do you wind up in Aspen?
Well, I knew Friedel Pfeiffer, who was running the ski school in Aspen. I knew him from racing, from St. Anton in Austria. He was in Sun Valley at first, you know.
This is in
he
Idaho.
He ran the ski school in Sun Valley, Idaho.
Yeah.
So I wrote him when I was in New York, and he said, well, yeah, come on out. So I went to Sun Valley, and I said, where do I find Friedel Pfeiffer? They said, well, in Aspen. I said, thank you. I went from the Challenger Inn into the Aspen Chalet, said, I'd like to talk to Friedel Pfeiffer. He said, oh, he's in Aspen. I said, well, isn't this the Aspen Chalet? He said, no, it's a new ski resort they're doing in Colorado. It's 800 miles from here. But it is because of Friedel that I came to Aspen.
In those very early days of the resort, you were a ski instructor. I understand you had some pretty notable ski students at that point.
Oh, yeah. Movie stars came here that used to go to Sun Valley. They were enamored with the new resort of Aspen. They came here like Gary Cooper and Ingrid Bergman and Lex Parker and all these guys.
Give me some gossip, yeah. Will you? Give me some gossip on, I don't know, Gary Cooper.
Gary Cooper?
Yeah.
Oh, he was great. One day I was in the Jerome lobby, Jerome Hotel here. And I had about six girls around me, which is nice. Gary came in and he said, Klaus, I don't know what you got that I ain't got. So the next morning we were at the breakfast bar. Gary was sitting next to me and next to him a girl. And when the girl found out it was Gary Cooper, she fainted and fell on the floor. And I said, Gary, I don't know what you got that I ain't got.
Did you get any of those famous students of yours to wear Obermeyer gear?
Oh, absolutely. Skiing used to be very formal. You skied in a necktie with a knickerbocker suit, you know, like in 1936, 37. There was a guy in Bavaria that made woolen fluffball ties instead of a necktie. You know, it was way out. So that caught on and got very popular. And so I made them here. And Gary came to me and said, Klaus, I hear you went in business for yourself. I said, yeah, I make these ties. He said, you know, maybe it'll help you if I put one on. I said, yeah, I'll give you one. He said, no, I pay retail.
Wow.
So he put it on and went all over the press. We ended up, in 3 years, we sold about 32,000 of those ties. And it died as fast as it developed also.
Well, Klaus, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure, and I hope we can ski together sometimes when you come up here.
Oh, that would be very nice. Thank you.
Okay.
Klaus Obermeyer is the founder of the ski clothing company Sport Obermeyer. He turns 93 next month and still skis. Our interview is from 2007. Now, back when Klaus was teaching stars like Gary Cooper to ski, no one was whizzing by on a snowboard. And yet the history of snowboarding goes back further than you might think. Something you learn at the Colorado Ski and Snowboard Museum in Vail. Trent Bush talked to us about that.
We have a board that is made by a company called the Bunker Company out of Chicago, Illinois. Two brothers, Gunnar and Harvey Bergeson, and their friend Vern Wickland. You could really look at it as being the first documented snowboard, at least in the United States, that we know of.
Does it look like a snowboard today?
There are similarities. It's probably 2.5-3 feet long, about a foot wide, and it has kind of a rocker shape, which is actually funny because the snowboard market has come back around to that shape. It's almost a U shape between the tip and the tail. And
so there's that little curve at the ends.
There's that little curve at the end, and the whole thing is a little bit curved. It has a rope for the nose, which is more like a snurfer or the earliest Burton snowboards. And then you have a little drag stick that you actually, you'd kind of hold onto the rope and lean back and trail the stick behind you to keep the nose up and then also to initiate turns.
It sounds complicated.
It's more complicated than what we know of today, but yeah. Actually it was pretty simple because, you know, it was something you could really just hop right on. If you look at the footage that we have from 1939, one of the inventors with their daughter riding it, it's pretty cool.
Do you get a sense in this exhibit of how snowboarding has become more and more legitimate?
You know, that's kind of the goal of the entire thing. Starting, you know, with the very, very early years, going through the 60s to Sherman Poppin and the Snurfer, which isn't really necessarily a snowboard as we know it, but it's a board with a rope in the nose, and it was made for surfing on snow. We have another board that Tom Sims, who Sims Snowboards has been kind of a mainstay in the snowboard market for a number of years, and we have a board he made in his high school shop class in 1963. You know, the roots are really there, and I think it's going to be really surprising.
Let's talk about Colorado's role specifically in the emergence of snowboarding. What would you point to in history here as a significant development?
I guess the 1981 contest at Ski Cooper, which was really the first true snowboarding contest. There were Snurfer contests before that, but this Ski Cooper event was definitely special. Jake Burton from the East and Tom Sims from the West, they all kind of converged on Ski Cooper in 1981.
I should say that that's a resort near Leadville, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Are there images from that competition?
You know, the entire thing was recorded on video, which is great. There's a man, Richard Christensen, who owned a snowboard shop on the hill in Boulder. It was actually a skateboard surf shop, and he began carrying snowboards in the late 70s, early 80s. And he actually put the contest together. And, yeah, so the entire thing is on video. It's called The Holy Grail. That's the name of the DVD.
It's the first contest ever, and I hope that it happens more often. But I'd like to see snowboarding and sticking reach the greatest, you know, ultimate high performance level, like pro surfing, you watch it. And we have the same potential here.
Well, that's from what is believed to be the first real snowboard competition that took place at Ski Cooper. Remind us of the date again, Trent.
1981.
Yeah. Do you get a sense in this exhibit for the tension between skiers and snowboarders?
You know, I've tried to kind of show that a bit. You know, these days especially, the tension is definitely eased. And it's interesting because you can look at the early years, then the 70s and the 80s, and see where snowboarding really was just going right down the path of skiing to the point of slalom contests and bump contests and all of those things, and really just trying to fit in and be on the mountain and enjoy being out there. And then it became a little more difficult because the mountains and the mountain managers and the ski industry was really, you know, reluctant, to say the least, in letting snowboards on the mountain. And that's really where the whole kind of rebellion came across.
And what did that rebellion look like?
The rebellion kind of took form in everything from clothing to just the way everybody held themselves. And a lot of it came more from a skateboarding sort of mentality. And with skateboarding came punk rock and grunge and all the things that were happening then. And so that mentality came over into the snowboard side.
Was there a resort in Colorado that was more open early on to snowboarding than another?
Sure. I Berthoud Pass, for sure, and the Garst family. It's an interesting story. They let them on right from the start. According to Ike, you know, the mountain manager came one day to him and said, "Hey, we have somebody out here with a snowboard." And he said, "Well, are they willing to buy a ticket?" And the mountain manager said, "Yes." And they said, "Let them on."
And we're talking about the ski area, the Berthoud Pass ski area.
Yeah, the Berthoud Pass ski area, which is no longer there.
Right.
But, you know, that was kind of one of the very first ski areas in Colorado that embraced snowboarding.
Huh. As long as they were willing to pay.
That's exactly right.
You have basically put this exhibit together, curated it, for free, you know? This is kind of a hobby for you, or an obsession, I'm not sure which.
It borders on both, for sure.
Is there an item you'd like to get your hands on?
You know, there are always items out there that are really interesting. The one item that we really wanted to get our hands on definitely slipped through our hands, and that was Sherman Poppin's first snurfer that he made for his daughters on Christmas of 1965. And before the museum was really kind of open arms to snowboarding, Sherman's wife called the museum and offered it to put it on display. And whoever was working at the front desk, you know, there's a gift shop as well as the office, and I don't think it even made it to the office. They said, no, you know, it's probably not something we'd really be interested in.
Ow.
So next day, she called the Smithsonian, and they said, yeah, let's take it, you know. And so now...
No way!
And everything else related to it are in the Smithsonian instead of the Colorado Ski and Snowboard Museum.
Trent, it's been fun. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Trent Bush created the snowboarding exhibit at the Colorado Ski and Snowboard Museum and Hall of Fame in Vail. Bush co-owns a Boulder-based snowboard equipment and apparel company that includes brands like Tech Nine and Nomis. We should mention that the exhibit includes something called Laz boarding. It's a version of snowboarding from Turkey that's 400 years old.
Aggressive alpine skiing.
Aggressive. Our ski down memory lane continues after a break with powder ghost towns, ski areas that have closed down but offer adventure to the backcountry skier. This is Colorado Matters from Colorado Public Radio. Among the ski areas that will welcome skiers this Thanksgiving weekend, you won't find names like Conquistador, Stoner, and Marble Mountain. That's because they and others have closed down over the years. Yet you can still ski there with a catch. You gotta trudge to the top yourself. The reward? Untracked snow and no lift lines. A guidebook called Powder Ghost Towns sketches the history of more than 30 failed ski areas and leads adventurous backcountry skiers to the trails. I spoke with author Peter Bronski back in 2009. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just glancing at the map at the start of the book, there are defunct ski areas all over the state. Why are there so many?
Yeah, you know, there's probably close to 200 defunct ski areas, 36 of which made it into the book. And there are lots of them for different reasons. Some of them couldn't stay with it financially over time. Others had problems with inconsistent snowfall. And others lost out due to competition when bigger resorts started to come online. So there were lots of reasons.
Well, let's explore some of those. Inconsistent snowfall.
Sure, particularly in the Front Range. You had ski areas in Boulder at Chautauqua Meadows, at Magic Mountain in Golden, the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs, all had ski areas that have since closed down, in part because those places don't get consistent snowfall anymore.
And then you said some had closed because of finances. Any theme to why finances got bad?
A pattern that you see emerge pretty commonly throughout the book is that smaller ski areas would have visions of being a larger ski area, and so they would invest in expanded infrastructure. They would build more trails, put in larger lift lines with overhead chairlifts, but ultimately be unable to pay for those upgrades.
Mortgage to the hilt, I guess.
Exactly, and that would put them into foreclosure, and they would ultimately close.
And then others died in the shadow of larger resorts. Give me an example of that.
Good example would be Meadow Mountain, which is in between Vail and Beaver Creek. Meadow Mountain opened roughly the same time as Vail Resort. Later, Beaver Creek came online, and Meadow Mountain was a smaller area that ultimately couldn't compete with the two neighboring resorts.
One thing that you get from reading the book is that it's actually hard to track down some of these defunct ski resorts. You're relying sort of on people's memories and topographical maps to pinpoint exactly where they were.
Absolutely. I started with a couple of good bases of information. The website ColoradoSkiHistory.com was one of those. Also in the late 1990s, Colorado Ski Country USA published a poster of lost resorts. And those gave me a good starting point. But even so, finding the specific locations of old ski areas proved really difficult. And so I tried to track down retired Forest Service rangers, old ski patrollers, in one instance even an archaeologist.
I did get the sense I don't know. It's so sad. It's like there was life in this place and there isn't anymore. And I wonder if there's one resort you felt strongly about that you missed without having ever really known it. Does that make sense?
Sure. The ones that I miss the most are the ones that had the most significant milestones in Colorado skiing history. The first overhead chairlift, the first night skiing, all those milestones were at lost ski areas. Pioneer Ski Area outside of Crested Butte had the first overhead chairlift. It was a single chair called the Comet, and it went into service in 1939.
Well, having talked a bit about some of these areas being defunct, let's talk about how one can bring them back to life. Through essentially backcountry skiing. For those who don't backcountry ski, what does that look like? I mean, I'm essentially going to an abandoned ski area and doing what?
Yeah, so the best way to think about these areas is consider them any other backcountry destination in Colorado. Although they once had lift serve skiing, where they had ski patrol and perhaps inbounds avalanche control, these are wild places today. And so when you're visiting them in the modern day, you're going into the Rocky Mountains in the wintertime and should be prepared for that.
You are self-propelling up the mountain in order to go down.
You absolutely are. If you're a skier, you're probably going to use skins, which are synthetic fibers you place underneath your ski, and that allows you to walk uphill in the skis without sliding backwards. If you use a snowboard, you could use snowshoes to go uphill. But either way, you're getting yourself to the top before you start going back down.
And how many runs are you getting in a day that way?
It depends on your motivation and the strength in your legs.
What's the most you've gotten in?
Probably 4 or 5 runs at a good place, and that might total anywhere from 1,000 up to 5,000 feet of vertical.
Are there ever any vestiges of the resorts around you, like, I don't know, old pylons that represented where a ski lift was or something?
Absolutely. The biggest common denominator are the runs themselves. Because of Colorado's high altitude and the dry climate, the trees regrow very slowly. So even resorts that closed decades ago are still really well preserved. But sometimes you'll find the foundations of the old lift towers, old cabins, abandoned condominiums. And in 2 cases, you'll still find the chairs hanging from the lift cables.
That is ghostly, isn't it?
It's a surreal experience to be at a place that still feels so much like a resort, but to be the only person there.
Are you ever trespassing?
No. All of the areas in the book take you on legal public property. That was one of the criteria for inclusion in the book, was that they all had to be publicly accessible.
That's Peter Bronski, author of Powder Ghost Towns. He spoke to us back in 2009. And that is our ski down memory lane. I'm Ryan Warner. Enjoy your Thanksgiving weekend.
On top of Copper Mountain, looking at the scene. Snow-capped peaks, ski slopes in between. Hilda Stratford zooming, new snow gently falling. Adrenaline gets pumping, aliveness is the calling. Skiing Copper Mountain, feeling fine.